last hour of Issues Etc. today, we're going to be talking about genetic science. This week's Time cover story, in fact, it was a special edition, Solving the Mysteries of DNA, the 50th anniversary, reliving Watson and Crick's historic discovery, these two kind of crotchety-looking guys building the model of DNA, telling us what the building blocks of our human frame look like. How much should we make of this? It used to be nature and nurture. It used to be you're born this way or you are made this way throughout your life. And now they talk about a criminal gene or a gay gene or a gene for compulsive lying. Are we really nothing more than the sum of our DNA? We're going to talk about genetic science during this hour of Issues, Etc. Joining us here in Studio A, Dr. Bob Weiss is our guest. He's Associate Professor of Practical Theology and Professor of Pastoral Ministry and Life Sciences at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. Bob, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
What do you make of the cover of Time magazine? I'll describe it very briefly, the picture. It is an Adam and Eve figure facing the viewer. They are standing kind of wrapped up in a double helix, and the helix above their heads resolves into the familiar tree of knowledge of good and evil, I assume it's supposed to be. What do you make of this? What do you think the message of this picture is on the cover of Time, this DNA issue?
That if these are representatives of Adam and Eve, that they are who they are and do what they do based on their genetic code called DNA, because it is entitled Solving the Mysteries of DNA. So this could very well be the tree of life that is exemplified here, so that from the tree of life came DNA, which gives us life, which is the secret of life, which is as when this all started in terms of identifying all 40,000 genes along the gene code we have in every cell. Then Watson and Crick, who are talked about in this article as the ones who discovered how this is coiled and uncoiled in a cell, they call this In Search of the Holy Grail. So that if one knows, learns how to uncode the code in DNA, then one may very well live forever.
All right, we'll get to a lot of issues, very current issues that deal with our DNA. But first, let's do the basic science, if we could, starting with the cell and the role that DNA plays in the human cell, and then, of course, in the entire development of a human being in their life. Tell us about the cell and its DNA.
Sure. What I'd like for your listeners to kind of envision is something that I think all of us, perhaps some of us don't like to eat, but some do like to eat, and that's just an egg. And we all know what an egg has a covering, and inside it has this kind of white stuff, and then it has a yellow center. So it's the yellow center that in a human cell we would call the nucleus. So we're going to equate this egg with the human cell. The yellow part, the yolk, has all of the genetic material in it that is necessary to, quote-unquote, make us who we are. That means that in a body cell, a skin cell, for example, if we open up a skin cell and look at the center part of it, the yolk of the skin cell, we find 46 chromosomes. We find in a man, we find 22 pairs, and then one pair, which would be an X and a Y. And in a woman, if we open up and unpack this skin cell with the yolk, we would find 22 pairs of chromosomes, and then we would find an X and an X, each identifying the latter as a woman, the former as a man.
And what is a chromosome?
Okay, if we take the genetic material in each one of these yolk cells, and we lie all this genetic material end to end, which in fact is a chromosome, we would have 1.8 meters or 6 feet. 6 feet of genetic material in each cell that God put there, enough genetic material in your human body of 100 trillion cells to go back and forth to the sun 250 times.
You so mean if we unwound the little packed up...
In every cell in your body, if we unwound all the genetic material in this yolk, the center of every cell in your body, unwound it, it would go back and forth to the sun 250 times. Now, that is a guesstimate from a molecular biologist I know in the state of Washington. And this would not all be uncommon to predict and calculate, knowing how many feet we have in every cell and guessing maybe 100 trillion or to 300 trillion cells we have. Now, a chromosome is easy to understand for your listeners. It's basically called dark body, chromosome. Body, soul means body, chromo means dark. So it's a darkly stained body. And within the chromosome, and the best way to think about this, I think for all of our listeners, we know what a cigar looks like, and that's exactly what a chromosome is. It's a cigar-shaped dark body, and within the chromosome, it is composed of this twisted helix of what's called genetic material, DNA. So, and within this chromosome, which houses the DNA, you have places along this DNA within the chromosome that are genes. Genes are, some people call, the smallest unit of heredity. For example, genes that cause eye color and hair color and so forth and so on. So we have 23 pairs, 46 chromosomes in each body cell. And in the sex cells, the sperm, we have 23, and in the egg, we have 23, just half that number. So if one were to take a look and envision, say, not the best example, but a cigar, or put a pencil on the table and form an X with it, cross two pencils, you would have the look of a chromosome. And if you unpack, or say, take off the outer covering of that lead pencil, inside of it, outside of that yellow or red color, whatever it is, you'd find the genetic material that contains the genes.
So we're really talking about, when we say, what does DNA stand for?
DNA is a complicated phrase called deoxyribonucleic acid, and that is the chemical composition of the chromosomes.
I've often seen it pictured, and you mentioned the double helix, pictured like kind of a twisted ladder.
Exactly.
It took a ladder and twisted it on its axis, so it's twisted around itself. And then, of course, all this stuff is wound up very tightly in the chromosome.
Yes.
But the legs of the actual rungs of the ladder are often depicted as two interconnecting molecules.
Yes.
And then the rails of the ladder are made up of individual molecules, too. Is that
separate.
An accurate picture?
Yes. That's, without getting into what these... the rungs of the ladder are, they're called base pairs. They have to, they can only hook up certain ways. They cannot mishook, but when they do, that's called mutation. That is a change that causes a lot of diseases and other difficulties in people's lives. And then the vertical part of the ladder that you so well described is what they call the sort of a backbone of the thing. It kind of holds this together, and then as it's twisted into this double, it's a helix, twisted twice, and then it's twisted on itself inside this tiny cell. So it's quite a marvelous creation by our Lord when the psalmist talks about fearfully and wonderfully made.
Now, the other view of DNA, of the chromosome, of our genetic material, doesn't include a picture of God at all. It is that this very marvelous and intricate and microscopic coding system for life evolved by random chance over millions of years from lower forms to higher forms through exactly what you mentioned before, mutation. Does mutation in genes ever result in the organism getting better? When someone said to me, you've got a mutation, I would take that as bad news.
It is bad news. This is always the point of contention between the so-called Darwinist, natural selection people that, as you have described, believe we descended from a common ancestor approximately over 60, well, let's say 5 billion years ago, when the Earth was pummeled by comets and meteorites that carried all this material with it. And then we developed through time from the ocean to land. And that in the same process, then so did DNA, sort of by mutation, random chance mutations, that these base pairs somehow came together and formed the basic unit of heredity. However, when one studies mutations in quote-unquote nature and watches this just on a farm, then you find that mutations are not good, that mutations are bad. So we're not talking about changing the code to create a drug or something like that. We're talking about something that wasn't normally there, that is now there, and this changes into something very detrimental. It is estimated that we humans have 4 to 6 lethal genes, i.e. genes that have mutated, that for whatever reason have not expressed themselves. And this always has remained a mystery for a lot of scientists.
So in other words, we carry around in our normal genetic code, on any given chromosome, we're going to find some mutations there that have potential danger.
It's a possibility, of course, yes. And, you know, this gets into the whole issue of cancer and other issues that people find in diseases. There are some 3,000 to 4,000 genetic disorders. For example, like Tay-Sachs disease, cystic fibrosis, Huntington's. And these are examples of the wrong code. These are examples of mutations that we would hope aren't there. But from our viewpoint as Christian Lutherans, we're talking about the corrupted body and soul, including the human genome.
The Time article talks about these two scientists, Watson and Crick. And what exactly did they do? Why was their discovery a milestone?
Well, they were just, to be brief about this, they were able to put research together that other people had done. And then they used models. And in this article, it points out that people didn't like models back in their day, back in the 40s and the 50s, of doing molecular biology, that is, looking into what makes this quote-unquote clock DNA really work and tick. And they said, hey, we can do this with models. If we know what the component parts of this are, we can draw a model and show this to you. We don't need X-ray photography and other fancy pieces of equipment. And so their whole mode of operation was to draw this model up. And they did the model. And they show a picture of the model in this magazine article. And so in 1953, when all of this was said and done, they published their paper in the journal Nature, I believe, and wasn't well received right away because it was kind of like, models? What's going on here? But finally, people started taking interest in it, and then they were awarded the Nobel Prize several years later.
Now, coming to more recent times, there was about 2 years ago a major effort being put forth in all sorts of genetic research to map the human genome. What exactly was that effort? What was its goal? And did it succeed in telling us, like a map, where everything lies on the human genetic ladder?
Okay, I'm going to take your last question first. Did they succeed in mapping out the entire human genome? No, they still have, by guesstimation, as they say, probably maybe another 5%, maybe 10% or so to go. But they have sufficiently mapped it out to know that instead of the so-called 100,000 genes that they thought were along the 6 feet of genetic material, there are only maybe max 40,000. They've mapped close to 34,000. So if you say, well, gee, they only have 6,000 more to go. But in fact, the whole story of the Human Genome Project begins with the Department of Energy back in 1985, when they wanted to learn what the effects of atomic radiation during Nagasaki and Hiroshima in World War II have on people, if any. And so the Department of Energy initiated this project called the Human Genome Initiative that soon turned into the Human Genome Project that Dr. Watson was the initial director up to about 1992 when Francis Collins took over. So they set out in 1990, officially in 1990, to set and map out all of these genes. And the target date was to finish in 2005. Well, in fact, they finished about year 2000, 5 years early, to map the genes. Now, I'm talking human genome. I'm only restricting this to the genetic material within the nucleus, that yolk we're talking about. And so they have moved very quickly. And I can describe, perhaps when we come back a bit later, how this can be done if we use the example of flying over the United States at night.
Well, let's go to that, but let me remind our listeners, we're talking about genetic science. There's a cover story in this week's Time special report called Unraveling the Mysteries of DNA. We're talking with Dr. Bob Weiss, discovering just exactly how mysterious it really is. He's Associate Professor of Practical Theology and Professor of Pastoral Ministry and Life Sciences at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. If you'd like to join us with a question or a comment, we will have time to take your phone calls, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Back to the map of the human genome. When they say they've mapped it, does that mean that they can point to a particular gene, a particular rung on the genetic ladder, and say, we know what it is and we know what it does in the human body?
In some cases, they can do that. In cases where they're dealing with just where one gene is doing one thing, for example, in the area of cystic fibrosis, which is it's a single gene issue, it is a recessive disorder, so they can locate the area on the chromosome, that is, the area of the DNA on the chromosome, where, and it's chromosome 7, where this is a problem. And they can do this with many, many diseases, and they can say, here's the area we need to look at and get down into, literally we would say, the streets, the houses, and the rooms, and the electrical wiring to find out exactly where we have this problem so it can be fixed. So they can do this with many, many genetic disorders.
Does that mean they know why the recessive gene has its result in a person's body? I guess what I'm trying to say is, when this was touted by the science community in 2000, as the mapping of the human genome, you would have thought they could tell you, like opening up a phone book, every single gene, what it does, and they could practically reconstruct a human being from genetic material.
Well, in fact, they cannot tell us exactly what every gene does or how these genes interlock and how they work with each other, because many of the characteristics that we have, including diseases, are not just one gene, but they're polygenic. That is, more than one gene most likely is involved in many of the characteristics that we inherit, like eye color, hair color, the way our nose is shaped, our mouth is shaped. So it's not easy to deal with multiple gene characteristics. It's much easier to deal with single gene characteristics, and that right now is a focus of genetic disorders. But not necessarily eye color, hair color.
We were probably all exposed to DNA, that term, most often when good old O.J. Simpson was on trial, because one of the key points of evidence was DNA evidence taken from the blood left there. What exactly were they doing there to try and fingerprint someone without fingerprints, but to identify someone through their genetic material?
Well, in fact, you've brought up the metaphor, the analogy that people use. We understand everyone has a unique, that is, a different specific fingerprint. When you put your thumbprint, your thumbprint, my thumbprint, Gary's thumbprint, everybody's thumbprint's different. And so is everybody's DNA is different. And so they talk about the genetic thumbprint then. So if they were to take, and they only need one blood cell, because every blood cell has 46 chromosomes, 6 feet of DNA. So when they take a little bit of dried blood, say off of the sidewalk at O.J. Simpson's house, and they analyze that blood, and they just simply can separate all of the genetic components. Basically, it's a sheet, it's a printout, and it has dark areas and light areas, and some of the dark areas are thicker. And they take what they find on the sidewalk, and they put it next to O.J. Simpson's blood that they took out of his vein, and they say, oh, why, these match. It has to come from his blood. And so it's a pattern. The genetic code is a pattern. And those women who are listening understand how important patterns are. So if the pattern fits, it's the person's.
I'm not going to go into the issue of why then O.J. Simpson is a free man, but...
It's easy. Actually, it was not as sophisticated in terms of the technology back then as it is now.
So in other words, they couldn't match as accurately?
Well, they matched it, but it was not accepted very well as authoritative as it is now.
On the other end of the spectrum, there are people who are being let off death row. This is news every day, because DNA evidence, we read this and it's never explained what happens, DNA evidence has been brought to light that shows they didn't do the crime. Is it the same kind of matching procedure?
Same kind of matching procedure. This could come from perhaps samples of semen from the man, because it still is, even though it's 23 chromosomes, they can still match 23. And if 23, say, from the skin cells match to 23 from, that is, of a man to his semen, it's a pattern, you see. And so when they say, well, there's not a match here. Or if there was some blood left behind, and they think, well, all the evidence points to this man, and they didn't have the DNA evidence, obviously, many years ago for many of these people, and now they just they can do this. They can melt down, literally, not with heat, with chemicals, the component parts of the blood cell, the old blood cells, withdraw the DNA, and get a pattern of, say, the so-called criminal. Then they take the person who's behind bars and they say, oh, these don't match. You didn't do this. You could not have done this. And that is true. And so that's why many criminals were prosecuted without DNA evidence are now released.
So we're talking about really kind of, we are on the cusp of this kind of science where DNA is actually being of some practical use to people.
Very much so.
Beyond just regulating their growth.
Very much so. In fact, there are places in the United States now, and I think it will soon become a federal law, probably within 10 years, that every criminal will have a genetic code laid aside and as an identifying mark, because it is clearly the most unique way to identify an individual, so that if anything, a crime is perpetrated, they will know immediately, just from a hair, a fingernail, one skin cell left behind. They will know if this person was involved or not.
Like keeping records of fingerprints.
Keeping records of fingerprints. And this is done, many people now are starting to have their children have blood stored and saved.
Why is that?
So that if there is an identification issue. I mean, this is what they're doing with, for example, the astronauts. If they don't have the dental work available, that is because the bodies were fairly well destroyed, but they can take skin cells, and they can take some of their old blood samples they have at NASA, and they can match the patterns of DNA, and they have now positively identified all the remains of the astronauts. And part of that positive identification certainly was through DNA.
What is genetic engineering? We've got about a minute before this break.
Genetic engineering, when we break it apart, of course, is engineering is the making of something, the setting out a pattern of design and making it. So genetic engineering would be setting out a pattern of design using genes to either alter, to create, either a new plant, animal, or what some people call a thing, that is a cross between a plant and an animal.
All right, when we come back from this break, we'll talk about some of those things. And we do have to discuss cloning, because cloning is also an issue of genetic science. In fact, it's crucial to understanding cloning, this genetic science. Dr. Bob Weiss is our guest, Associate Professor of Practical Theology and Professor of Pastoral Ministry and the Life Sciences at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. We're talking about genetic science. When we come back, what does God's Word have to say, if anything, about genetic engineering? Is God's Word silent on this? Is there nothing to guide us as science continues to pursue at a pretty breakneck pace the manipulation of genes, the mapping of genes, and the exploration of what our genes might mean for us? Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. And we talked about it in the last hour a little bit. There's that Raelian UFO cult that also claims that we are the genetic ancestors of space aliens. We'll be right back.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. However, we are not funded by the church body. We're also not affiliated with Lutheran Hour Ministries or the Lutheran Layman's League. Issues, Etc. is supported by listeners like you. Please help support this worldwide outreach by making a gift this week. Our address, Issues, Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Thanks for your prayerful consideration.
Wouldn't it be great if we went through life without any problems? Well, that's just not the way things are. Life can get tough, but we can face whatever comes along with peace and confidence, because there is reason for hope. We're your neighbors, the people of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and we'd like you to know that with Christ, there's plenty of hope to go around.
A message from your friends at Issues, Etc.
Aborigines, they've the same stories as ours.
Answers with Ken Ham, a popular Australian speaker on the book of Genesis. Well, Ken, I know that you're alluding to the fact that cultures throughout the world, including the Australian Aborigines in your homeland, have legends that sound like they came from the Book of Genesis.
I recall the time a missionary to the Australian Aborigines attended one of our seminars. Because I knew that cultures all over the world had flood legends similar to the historical account in Genesis, I asked him if the Aborigines had any such stories. I explained to him that the reasons these stories abound all over the world is that they were handed down from the time of Noah, even though they were changed somewhat. The real record, of course, is in the Bible. This evidence attests to the fact that all cultures are of one race, descended from Noah and ultimately Adam. You know, a few years later, the same missionary recounted the event of an old Aboriginal elder who told him that the Aborigines had a story handed down for generations that woman was made while man was asleep. Now, remembering our earlier conversation, the missionary opened the Bible and read the account of the creation of Eve. The Aboriginal said, "How come you have the same story we have, but your story is better?" The missionary was able to lead this man to the Lord Jesus Christ.
We can help you strengthen your faith in the Bible and witness more effectively when you read the many faith-building and evangelistic articles on our popular website, AnswersRadio.com. Ken Ham's booklets are available free when you log on to AnswersRadio.com.
5:31, good evening. AM 850 KFUO weather. Occasional rain overnight with a low of 38. Occasional rain also tomorrow, 52 for the high right now. Cloudy in St. Louis, 46. In traffic, westbound 40 between Clayton, Skeeker, and Hanley. So slow and crowded at Brentwood out to McKnight. Slow 270 through Mason. Eastbound 270 at Lindbergh, there's a disabled vehicle in the center lane. That's blocking traffic, and traffic is jammed back to Missouri Bottom Road. Eastbound 40 between Brentwood and Hanley, there's slow traffic. Westbound 70 at Cypress Heavy. Traffic is slow from Earth City across the Blanchet Bridge in the right lane, approaching 94, busy 370 out to Mid Rivers. And eastbound 40 before Jefferson, slow traffic heading towards the Poplar Street Bridge. And northbound 55 at Park Avenue, slow traffic in the right lane heading towards the Poplar Street Bridge.
Sign on at 7 tomorrow. It'll be our Valentine's Spectacular on the morning show on AM 850 KFUO. Larry Carter will be here. Marty Linfett checks in from Concordia Seminary. We'll hear commentary from Dr. Dale Meyer. And we'll play Bible Brain Teaser in the morning, give you a chance to win some goodies. It'll be a special Valentine's Day here on the morning show on Inspirational Christian Radio, AM 850 KFUO.
Sunday on Issues Etc., Phyllis Schlafly will join us. We're going to talk about feminism. Has it run counter to nature, feminism? Has it done any good for women? Are women better off or worse off because of feminism? That's live Sunday night from 10 to 11 on 91.5 FM here in St. Louis. Phyllis Schlafly will be our guest. You can also post a question or a comment in advance of Sunday night's program with Phyllis on the issue of feminism by going to our Issues Etc. website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section, and there you're going to find a link to our Issues Etc. forum. It's the place we reserve for you, your questions, and your comments in advance of the Sunday night program. We'll be talking about feminism. Give it some thought, and any time of day or night, click on our website, issuesetc.org, the What's New section, and post your question or comment on our Issues Etc. forum. We will have Phyllis try and deal with those during the Sunday night program. If you have a question or comment on genetic science, on genetic engineering, on the human genome, we're talking with Dr. Bob Weiss, Associate Professor of Practical Theology and Professor of Pastoral Ministry in the Life Sciences at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis, about genetic science. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Before the break, I asked you, what is genetic engineering? And you said basically, you said it could be done with food or people or anything like this at this point. The big issue in the news is genetically manipulated food, a food supply. Do we eat genetically manipulated food? Is that something that people should be worried about?
Well, first, we are eating some genetically manipulated food, and it's so identified at the supermarket. You know, we're not looking at tomatoes that are 10 feet in diameter. We're looking at organisms, that is, genes that have been altered in these tomatoes to make them more, you know, bug-resistant or fungus-resistant. And the difficulty with determining whether or not that's beneficial to humankind is long-term impact of having genes in your body that come from altered quote-unquote food.
But even if eating a genetically manipulated tomato will never cause me any harm, physically, or anything else, from a Christian standpoint, is it unnatural? Is it out of the scope of what God intended for man to do?
I don't believe it is. Of Native Americans, you know, maize, corn, was developed, you know, initially through very rough, cursory genetic manipulation of corn seeds. And we're still eating it. And we're still getting varieties of corn that are produced through various ways of pollination that we've been dealing with for decades. So I'm not much of an alarmist about this. Recently, as you well know, from the University of Illinois, some hogs were released that were genetically enhanced and ended up on the supermarket someplace. And they were told, you know, get them back. Well, there's no way they know at this point in time. And the University of Illinois geneticist said, hey, there's no problem. I mean, these were not altered in a way that would impact a human diet in our synthesis of proteins and enzymes and things.
All right, cloning. We've talked about cloning before, and you have, in the explanation of what happens in cloning, resorted to describing what you described in the beginning of our conversation. Chromosomes coming together. A very brief description of somatic nuclear cell transfer or human cloning. What happens?
Well, again, let's go back to Easter is fast approaching, and certainly everybody understands, you know, the plastic Easter eggs people get and filled full of jelly beans. Let's take a plastic Easter egg and put one jelly bean in it. The jelly bean now is this yolk, this center that has genetic material. The Easter egg is a woman's oocyte or egg from her ovary. So we have a plastic egg. I'm not trying to demean women's. I don't want to get into the feminist thing with Phyllis Schlafly on this one, but we're not trying to demean the woman's ovaries and eggs, but by way of example, we have a plastic egg that has a jelly bean in it, and the jelly bean is the nuclear material, the genetic material. And then let's say you wanted to clone yourself, so that in case you want to go on vacation, your clone could sit in here at Issues, etc., and take over for you, as long as, quote-unquote, your clone was trained well. Okay,
and was long enough to train,
and was an ordained clergyman. Now, so we would take a skin cell from you. Could be from your arm, could be from your calf, could be from any place on your body. A skin cell that would have 46 chromosomes in it, including your X and Y. If we did a woman, same thing. Skin cell would have an XX. So let's say we put on the table this woman's egg, plastic egg with the jelly bean in it, and next to it, we have the skin cell with 46 chromosomes in it. Okay, what we do is put a needle into the plastic egg and take out the woman's genetic material. So she has no nuclear genetic material. That is, the center has been taken out. So you have an empty oocyte, an empty egg. That is, the yolk of the chicken's egg would be gone.
Okay.
Now we take the genetic material with a little electricity and move that genetic material from your skin cell into the empty egg. So the third step then is the empty egg now has 46 chromosomes in it.
My chromosomes?
Your 46 chromosomes.
All right.
Including the X and the Y. If it were ladies, it would have the X and the X. All 46. And 46 chromosomes are the total complement you need to, quote unquote, make a human being. Then this egg, and I'm going to use a philosophical term, thinks that it's fertilized, although no sperm has been used. No sperm has been used, and then it's put into a surrogate womb, somebody else's womb, so that it would develop 38 to 42 weeks, and then this lady then would give birth to you, your clone.
My exact genetic twin would be my clone.
Yes, only in genetics.
That clone wouldn't be me.
No, wouldn't be you. It would look like you in a lot of ways. And there may be some little tweaks here and there that might be a bit different, but in general, it would look like Pastor Todd Wilkin.
Would that clone be a full human being with everything that Scripture describes as
composing the human nature, be it body, soul, spirit, whatever, however you break the man down.
Yes. Yes.
Now, are we able to do that?
Well, actually, it has been done. They have cloned one human embryo in Wisconsin at Advanced Cell Technology and got it to about one was three cell, one was five cell stage. But beyond that, no. There is no recorded peer-reviewed journal article that demonstrates that a human being brought to full term has been cloned.
So all the talk that we're having now, and we discussed this quite a bit on Issues, etc. In fact, for Roe v. Wade, we talked with several senators, Brownback and Santorum. Both of them were intent upon seeing a total ban on human cloning. And they said, now's the time to do it, because if we don't do it now, someone will clone a baby. Do you agree with them?
I agree. And, you know, it's this familiar analogy or metaphor that all of us are understanding that as the Mount Everest syndrome. It's there. We're going to climb it. We're going to do it. Somebody, because it's a challenge to not just the human brain, but to the human brain who deals with this technology of cloning, so that some may say, we were first. Certainly money is going to be involved. The Raelians, when they said they supposedly brought this clone child in on December the 26th when they announced this, they said, well, it costs about $200,000 per child to clone. I'm not sure how they arrived at that figure. So this is kind of where we're heading, that I believe they are correct to abandon all forms of cloning.
All right. We're going to take some phone calls. I want an answer. We have to leave that hanging, because the real question is, why are they correct in banning it? Is it dangerous, or is it actually immoral against the laws of God? Roland is calling from St. Louis Hills. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Roland, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you. Good evening. And
good evening.
Doctor, congratulations on the anniversary of your ordination. I saw that in the newsletter that comes around.
Oh, thank you very much.
What I'm interested in is tying this to evolution and how they use mitochondrial DNA to search for Eve. Which
sure.
I think is kind of fascinating. If you could sort of throw that into the discussion, I'd appreciate it.
All right. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. That's even mentioned in the Time magazine article. Someone has searched that we have found the mitochondrial Eve. What are they claiming?
And Adam, too. Actually, what they do is mitochondrial DNA, as it's passed along from woman to woman, it literally, now this is a small cell organelle, a small part of a big cell that lives outside of the nucleus. That is what we, the yolk, which kind of lives out there.
You're talking about the mitochondria.
The mitochondria.
Okay.
It's kind of an energy producing sort of a cell. And this remains rather constant from generation to generation. This we understand, and this we know. So what they did in terms of Darwinian evolution, natural selection, survival of the fittest, they have created a new phrase called neo-Darwinism, new Darwinism, which uses and utilizes genetics to explain our ascent, our descent from a common ancestor. So they go to sub-Saharan Africa, where many believe this is where we originated, and they look at the mitochondrial DNA of groups of people there now, and have a pattern and say, you know, when we go study the people in America or Europe, the people in Europe seem to be closer to the DNA pattern, mitochondrial DNA, as those in sub-Saharan Africa. So their ancestry is closer. The ones that are farther removed have a more distant pattern. They're not the same pattern, but all have areas of similarity. So they concluded, literally, that there were 18 Eves and 10 Adams in the original population of, I'm going to say, proto-humans, for lack of a better term to get not so specific, in sub-Saharan Africa over 2 million years ago. And this is what they have come up with. This is the so-called mitochondrial Eve.
So in other words, by tracing the pattern, the similarities of patterns of mitochondrial DNA through various populations as they exist in the world today, they've applied it to the geography of this planet and said it all seems to center
right
on sub-Saharan Africa.
Yes.
And this 18 Eves and 10 Adams, is this just sheer speculation?
This is speculation based on the given populations of the world, that they surmise that it would take at least that many to present the genetic variation that we have in the world today.
As a theologian, and I know that you accept without qualification Scripture's account of human origins, 6 days creation, Adam, divine creation of God, Adam and Eve, the fall, the whole thing. Adam and Eve are our parents. Does that still intrigue you that we can find a pattern that shows that human beings are of common ancestry,
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely intrigues me. In fact, I think it testifies to what the Lord did in the very beginning, that we do have a common ancestor. So in my classes, when they talk about Adam and Eve, and I tell the students, I said, now, here we got the theory of mitochondrial Eve, the 18 Eves and 10 Adams. I said, how would you deal with this in a Bible class? I said, well, you can take the names Adam and Eve and go right back to the Bible and find out about the real Adam and the real Eve, that they're not mitochondria.
Do you buy the 2 million, 20 million, 200 million year time frame?
No, I do not buy that at all. I don't believe that science, I'm not going to say science because Darwinian evolution is not science, and you've had programs on this a lot recently, but I do not believe that I ascended from a monkey 60 million years ago.
But the case is always made, Bob. We share 98% of our genetic material with the modern chimpanzee, ergo common ancestry.
Isn't God consistent in his creation? That's how I respond to that. That if, in fact, all of a sudden we had, I'm not sure what that means, you know, so you say we have 99% similarity, that is, but that doesn't talk about the function. You see, this is one thing you don't hear. Well, does that mean that just because we have the same pattern, do we have the same function within this pattern? And this gets a bit technical, in my opinion, at this point. Do the genes that, say, for eye color in the chimpanzee are the same for the human? Well, so what? What does that prove? It still proves nothing. It just says that we have the same genes. Well, we have every plant, every animal, every human being has the same base pairs. We have the same genetic code in the context of how it's made up. And if, in fact, we didn't have it, we wouldn't be able to eat cows and pigs, horses, whatever you eat, you know, vegetables, legumes. And our body wouldn't be able to reproduce the enzymes and proteins we have.
So, in other words, if we didn't share the genetic material with the chimpanzees, we wouldn't be around to talk about
it. We wouldn't be around to talk about it, precisely. So I just find that when people want to look for similarities within the genetic code, that we ascended from Obor monkeys 60 million years ago, when purportedly they came into being from dinosaurs, basically, from a dinosaur type called Proconsul, that to me this is all of God's wonderful creative act. I don't believe I came from a monkey. I think what many evolutionists are looking at is probably change within the species of the monkey, the kinds that God created, and probably change within human beings, but not the transition from monkey to human.
You said before we talked to Roland that you agree with the efforts of the senators who would like to ban all human cloning. Is it simply because it's stepped too far in science, it's too unsure, too many risks involved, or too expensive? Why would you see the banning of all human cloning?
Well, I think from our perspective of in the kingdom of power, that it violates the Nuremberg Code, for one thing.
What do you mean by that?
Well, it violates the issue of experimentation, where you must need consent of the quote-unquote human being you're dealing with. And when you study the Nuremberg Code, and that is the court system of the 23 war criminals that also experimented on pregnant women and children in the womb, that was one of the precise directives of the Nuremberg Code. The 10 points of the code was that no experimentation should be conducted on any human being without their consent. You cannot get consent of the quote-unquote cloned person. So it violates the Nuremberg Code, it violates the Helsinki Code, certainly violates Scripture with one flesh union, that marriage is a bond that God has brought together at his altar of grace, so that from a theological perspective, to me, this is an easy call. One does not create yourself Otherwise, what you have done is cloned the Tower of Babel in your life. So this whole issue of cloning Brownback and the rest that do not want to do it, they really are reflecting back on the culture that Hitler brought to bear and how the United States contributed to that culture in our quest of eugenic engineering, which is part of the cloning, of making a more perfect and better world. And we were involved with that from about 1920s to 1972 when we were eugenically sterilizing more than 80,000 people here in the United States.
Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. With a few minutes left in this conversation, Dennis is calling from his car. Hi, Dennis.
Hello, how are you today, sir?
Very well, Dennis.
My question is scientifically, will it be feasible to possibly take, I suppose, cells from someone who had liver disease or heart disease and be able to clone that individual's heart for a heart transplant or something similar to that?
It's a good question, sure. Dennis. And this is the kind of thing that, at least in the popular literature, Bob, these things are being promised. You know, if you got a bad heart, bad brain, bad anything, we'll be able to clone it for you. Replacement parts.
Yeah, this is getting into the difference between therapeutic cloning, that is creating yourself through cloning, which we described, letting you grow to about the fifth day in your human development, and then killing you, taking out the cells that will produce the heart, the liver, the lungs, whatever it might be, and then freezing those until perhaps we need them at a later date to save you from, say, a heart attack, a heart transplant, kidney transplant, lung transplant, brain transplant, whatever it might be.
But you said, even though it may be possible to do this, it would require the destruction of that human clone.
It would require the destruction of the human clone. So the presuppositions, which you speak all the time about on Issues, etc., where you begin is where you're going to go. So if you believe the clone is not a human being, and this is the controversy, then you can do quote-unquote therapeutic cloning, and that's not a problem. The reproductive cloning, they don't want to do that, the government, because they say, well, you know, you don't want to do that. It's really the yuck factor. Mm-hmm. You know, it's yucky. Well, why is it yucky? Well, it just seems to be immoral. Well, why is it immoral? And really why it's immoral is because they're getting their presuppositions from the Bible and the quote-unquote Hitler's Aryan race. That still is lingering about, fortunately, trying to control people, but one has to understand that there is no difference between therapeutic cloning, that is the process, and reproductive cloning. It is the same. The result is different.
So the price to pay for cloned organs would be the life of that embryo, which the organs would be drawn.
Exactly. If you're going to do embryonic research, if you're going to take adult cells from bone marrow or umbilical cord cells, which many people are freezing now, that does not involve the destruction of a human being. It is simply putting them aside for later use, which I don't have a difficulty with, because we're not destroying a human being.
Let's go back to the phones. Calling from his car, John is on the line. Hi, John. Welcome to Issues, Etc.
I got a quick question regarding, if I were to be cloned, does that mean that that child, that baby at year one, will look exactly like I did when I was 1 year old and so on at 5 years old and things like that? So looks will be exactly the same, but not necessarily the personality and things like that, or is that all the same too?
All right. Thank you very much. How much is controlled by these genes? It's kind of back to that question.
Well, I think what we're finding in the literature is that, yes, this child would be a twin of the person from whom it was cloned. As I said, there would probably be some differences due to things that happen within the genome, within the nuclear DNA. There might be hair color could be different. They learned this when they cloned the first cat. There could be different hair color. There might be maybe some eye color's difference or other things. But in general, when you would look at this child all the way through its development, you would say, oh, that looks just like me. But I think from our viewpoint in theology and as living life as a Christian, we have to ask the question, what is a child? And I know Dr. Gilbert Mailander at Valpo does a sterling job with this in many of his papers. You know, is a clone of me, if my wife and I were to say, we'd like to have a child, we're going to clone Bob, would that be a child? Would that be our child? No, would not be our child. It would
be your brother.
It would be my twin brother and my parents' son.
Yeah, I don't even want to go there. Jim, we've only got a few minutes here. I don't want another one of you around, frankly. One is enough.
One's enough for me.
Todd, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And, Dr. Weiss, thank you for your work. Todd, I just wanted to let you know at the state level also, the two bills have been introduced, House Bill 209 and House Bill 163 to ban cloning in our state in Missouri. And because of Dr. Bob Weiss and his efforts coming down to testify on our behalf and on behalf of the bills, we've got some a real good bill and some real good language, and I just wanted to let your listeners know that we have efforts at the state level also to ban cloning and to take a leadership role on this.
Thank you very much, Jim. I appreciate the call. That's Jim Lemke. He's a Missouri state representative and a listener to Issues, etc. How did you make the case when you go and testify before lawmakers who don't know what's going on? And they can't tell the difference between, they don't know that therapeutic cloning and reproductive cloning is the same thing. How do you make the case?
Well, with the limited time, I started with them. And I started with them as an adult and worked their way back through their development into the womb. Back to the very earliest stages when they were a one-day-old zygote, an embryo. And I said, very early in the discussion, I said, and you know that. And from that point on, establishing the presupposition that even the human cloned embryo is a human being, then I started to make my case relating to the difference between therapeutic and reproductive cloning, citing that George Orwell's comment, one who controls the language controls the debate, using some things that I normally don't use in a class, but that they would resonate to.
Now, one last question with 30 seconds. Has genetic science crossed the line? Are we in pretty much all over the place on thin ice with regard to our pursuit of unraveling the mysteries of DNA?
I think from a secular position, we are getting information in the unraveling of the genetic code that is misleading people regarding the relationship of the body and the soul, so that people have to understand from the doctrine of original sin, our DNA is corrupted now. It is corrupted. And as you started the program off, which was really very good, we are more than our genes. We are a body and the soul, and Jesus died for more than just my genes.
Dr. Bob Weiss, thank you for being our guest.
Thank you.
You know, we can manipulate genes, we can map the genome. We will not find the sin gene. We won't. The only solution for our real problem, the root of all the other problems, is the shed blood of Jesus Christ. Real, live blood running down his body on the cross cleanses us from all sin. You know what? It doesn't take care of our genetic mutations. That will await the resurrection. We'll be restored to perfect genetic purity. But that's just icing on the cake, folks. We have eternal life in Jesus Christ because he solved our real problem, which isn't genetic. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues, Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod. Today's Issues, Etc. broadcast was partially underwritten by Concordia Publishing House, publishers of the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for February, Testing the Claims of Church Growth. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House at 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or go to issuesetc.org, and under the What's New section, you'll find information on our Issues Etc. Book of the Month, Testing the Claims of Church Growth.